Ambassador, we're discussing the question of international justice and, first of all, whether it's subject now to threat, and if so, what is the threat? What does the threat consist of? What are the phenomena that we are witnessing today that you believe to be most concerning to the system of international justice?
Okay, Thomas, this is a question to me.
You have the floor, but feel free.
No, thank you. There might have been a slight misunderstanding. I thought I would have asked to speak first about Greenland and the international law and the reaction of it, but I will react to your question on the cracks of international law, and I don't know when I will have the possibility then to speak about Greenland, maybe thereafter. Is that fine?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I could imagine on the cracks, ways. Yeah.
On the cracks of international law, I would say that, and the answer to the question of the title of the seminar is the architecture of international justice under threat. And I definitely would say yes. And there are bigger cracks in international law. If you look at the architecture of international law, the simple blueprint is the Charter of the United Nations. And we all know the reason why it has been created straight after the World War, where the people really wanted to end violence, wanted to have peace, wanted to have respect of sovereignty and respect for international treaties. For the implementation of the border, they had an architecture which based on, mainly I would say, a General Assembly and the Security Council. And having followed myself, having been an EU diplomat with the UN in New York and Geneva, it was clear from the beginning that the architecture itself was quite imperfect. And maybe not so much the General Assembly, which does not have executive powers, but particularly the Security Council. The Security Council, and although a revision of the Security Council is going on since many years, the big problem is you have the veto right of one of the five permanent members of the Security Council. So the question that you also ask was, is there a crisis in enforcement? I would say, yes, the crisis of enforcement is there, but this crisis of enforcement is not so new. I would say that it has been existing for a while because of this weak architecture, but I would say is more new is that in recent years, the validity and the acceptance of the UN Charter and international law has diminished considerably. And what we are facing today are, for example, illegal acts of aggression by states, which are very, very clearly a breach with the UN Charter. And you know, you're the lawyers present that you can only have two very clear exceptions to the use of force against other states, as in case of self-defense, of an armed attack, or when it's allowed by the UN Security Council. So none of these cases, conditions are met in the recent cases of aggression or the threat of aggression. And the threat of aggression has been present for a moment, for example, with Greenland. But I would say that even worse is not only the crack which exists, but that the breach of international law is becoming the new normal. And that's extremely worrying. If you look at the actions of the US in Venezuela and in other countries, which we were asked maybe not to mention, shows a very, very dangerous trend for the moment. It's becoming increasingly normal that the states use unilateral force as a means of power, which means that there is a normalization of the violation of international law. And so today we have a situation where we still have the charter which exists, but there is hardly anybody who feels bound by it. And the examples are the Russian war, the aggression against Ukraine, Trump's claim regarding Greenland, or kidnapping the president of Venezuela. So I would say that there are the threats, and the non-respect of international law is becoming the is the new normal, and that's extremely worrying. There's a big crack, and therefore, and also based maybe on the example that I will hope to be able to give later on Greenland, is how and can we stand up against that? And there, the example of the European Union is a very good one in the case of Greenland. In any case, because there it was very clear that President Trump has really trespassing wet lines, and the attitude of the EU has been standing firm together, courageous, showing strength and determination, and I think that was a way to Trump to persuade him. For the moment, in any case, to give in on Greenland, and I would say that such a firm attitude helps definitely the rule of law and international justice to regain respect despite the big cracks that exist.
I'll just ask for any member of the panel who would like to comment. It is sometimes asked whether the difficulty is in implementation or enforcement of particular parts of a system, or is it a meta problem, a problem of legitimacy of the system? I also wonder, are we looking, we talk about enforcement, and we've all used the term enforcement in the last 20 minutes. I didn't keep count, but we talked about enforcement quite a bit. Is enforcement the same thing as compliance? And with respect to international law, I want to bracket the suggestion that the distinction between enforcement as a term and compliance as a term might not be just semantics. Does anyone care to comment on that intended provocation? Let me heighten the provocation. International law has never had an enforcement system to speak of, or not much of an enforcement system compared to municipal systems of law. Instead, it has relied on that second word, compliance. And if we're talking about particular dimensions of what we're referring to here as a crisis, are we talking about an enforcement crisis or a compliance crisis? And the reason I ask is, if we say that there's an enforcement crisis, well, welcome to 2026. You might as well have said it in 2016 or 2006 or 1996 or 1896, because that's been a distinguishing thing about international law, the lack of centralized enforcement. So just comment, enforcement or compliance? And what do you make of that? Start with Professor Padfield.
Okay, well, it all depends what you want to enforce and who you're wanting to comply. So I think I have to go back to my starting point, which I'm a pretty odd person to bring onto a panel to talk about international justice, because I have always been deeply skeptical about international justice, international law. I am a domestic criminal lawyer through and through. A human rights lawyer, if you like, though, yes, people should have their rights respected. Increasingly, I worry about trees and rivers and animals and whether they should have their rights respected too. And my working life has been thoroughly immersed in worrying about the rights of the individual, whatever we mean. So I find your question on enforcement compliance really interesting. I think I want to say also, in all honesty, that I have been disappointed over the years how many students turn up wanting to do PhDs in international law, particularly international criminal law, and can I get them into police stations and prisons to look at the reality of life on the ground? So I want to enforce a much better criminal justice system everywhere. I want us to worry about compliance. Why do people obey the law? And how much does international law really help? one takeaway message from this afternoon. I have no idea how many of you have seen the documentary War Done Done. Hands up who's seen War Done Done. All go home this evening. It's a film made in 2010 by Rebecca Richmond Cohen. It's about the trial before the Special Court for Sierra Leone of Issa Cisse, a leader in Sierra Leone's civil war between 2000 and 2009. And it illustrates beautifully all my concerns about international criminal justice. It raises concerns about the extraordinary costs of the trial, the beneficiaries in the eyes of the filmmaker, the British and American lawyers are the main beneficiaries of the trial. They contrast beautifully, the American and the British lawyers, with the women in the marketplace who they interview about the lack of any police force working in Sierra Leone at the time that this very expensive criminal trial going on. So your question encourages us to think very hard about where our priorities lie, and we want to safeguard the safety of ordinary people, don't we? And if we know that prosecuting the few has very little impact on safeguarding the safety of the few. Of course, the answers are really complex. And of course, I'm simplifying the question. One of the reasons I was very interested to accept your kind invitation today is, having been a real skeptic about international law for the last 40 years, today I'm changing my mind a little bit. I think, oh, maybe we do need international law. When we see the architecture so obviously cracking, there's so clearly a need for the rule of law at many levels, and we could go on to discuss later levels of accountability, which stages matter most. And I used to think the domestic stage was much more important for safeguarding the rights of individual people. Now I think I recognise that we need many stages and we need to worry about the architecture of those stages. So a rather long answer, but I think we've got to think long and hard about what we're wanting to enforce before we work out how we think it's effective to enforce it. Thank you.
Sir, what do you think? Enforcement or compliance?
It's an interesting question. And to my mind, I practice in international economic law a lot. And in that context, you can draw quite a clear distinction, I think, in terms of if there is a judgment or an award, will they comply or do I need to enforce? But I think if you take a step back and look at it from a broader perspective, and you ask the question, why are they complying? And I would suggest it is the stick, right? The stick. What stick will be used against me if I do not comply? And then is enforcement also a manifestation of the stick? Is it the actual exercise of the stick making them comply? And if I go back to my economic law, international economic law example, will the state pay £100 million pounds in damages because it just feels like it's going to comply, or are they complying because there is a stick and the judgment creditor, whoever it is, has a means to get that £100 million pounds? And if a state is being belligerent and has formed the view, you're probably not getting it 100, maybe if you try, you might get 50 out of me, you're going to have to chase me for 5 to 10 years. I'm going to take my chances. Maybe enforcement is the exercise of the stick by the judgment creditor, the award creditor, and you go down that path. So the common theme I see in the two terms you've put to us, Tom, is that perhaps they connect at the stick. And in the context of international law, maybe the question that needs to be asked is, in respect of each obligation, whatever that obligation may be in different parts of international law, what is the stick and how effective is the stick to get states to comply either voluntarily or have them comply by way of enforcement?
Ambassador Koenigs, hope you can hear us.
Yes. Thank you. I personally think that it's not an either or if we are here in the crisis of implementation or of enforcement or compliance. As I said before, there is a crisis of enforcement which exists already a long time and which is linked a little bit to the architecture of international law, where there are no real instruments for enforcement. Looking, for example, at the UN Charter, there are no instruments really for enforcement. Or if there are instruments, they can be blocked, let's say, by the veto powers of some states. And this maybe is a big difference between international law and European law. In European law, we have a very, very clear enforcement because we have enforcement mechanism, and this made this so strong regarding the implementation. So I think there is an enforcement problem, which is not new, and there is also a crisis of the compliance. And I said before, the crisis of compliance is linked to the fact that there is a crisis of validity and acceptance of international law, which even has been, I think, reinforced by the fact that multilateralism is being affected with a retreat of multilateralism. There are some states which are just stopping their international agreements they have accepted. So the multilateral system for the moment is under very, very big threat. And it doesn't matter of the subject that, for example, if climate change or other, where big states are just withdrawing their membership of important UN programs or UN agreements. So I would say that the compliance is linked also with the weakening of the multilateral system.
Okay. Now, I am reminded that we, as part of our ground rules, decided, and I shall now confess to personal non-compliance, I was to have invited each of you to open with 8 to 10 minutes. And I understand that the organizers, who indeed did inform me of this, so it's all down to me, but may I invite you, maybe more by way of a closing that would then leave the balance of our time for a discussion with our colleagues and friends in the audience. And if we could do this in the same order as we began, if that's agreeable to all of you. Yes? Is that right? And I appreciate you, that you might already have presaged some of your opening remarks as we're now at the closer to the closing than the opening. But Professor Padfield, if you would take the baton.
Right. I think I'm quite confused. I squeezed what I wanted to say in many ways into my last answer by raising questions of skepticism about what some levels of international, particularly criminal law, might be seeking to achieve and whether they're effective in the way they seek to achieve them. I think these levels of accountability are really interesting. I disagreed with my learned friend over there who seemed to think that domestic criminal justice was alive and well and healthy. In this country, domestic criminal justice is not alive and well and healthy. Today, a notorious murderer has died of the injuries he received in prison, and one of the first duties of the prison is to keep people safe inside it. There are many courthouses in this country where the roofs are leaking, and that's this country before you get to Sierra Leone or anywhere else. So there are problems with justice, and I think there are really serious questions to think about levels of accountability, whether we believe in local justice or national justice or regional justice or global justice. And as I said earlier, I do think that I am shifting in my views to thinking that there is a greater role for global justice than I used to think. partly because the world is getting smaller in some ways all the time. I gave a lecture to 95 human rights lawyers in Tehran last week. And that, to me, has been enormously powerful as a thought. Before you ask, now, I did not go to Tehran last week. You would be very foolish as a British woman to go to Tehran to give a lecture. But I gave my lecture online. And now look at what's happening in Tehran. So global justice is problematic. And it's really, really important that we find ways of talking to each other, human to human. I wanted to mention very briefly the European Convention on Human Rights, because from where I sit, it says very little. It was a very cautious document drawn up at the end of the Second World War, and I challenge anyone to read it and find anything to take issue with, except for what it doesn't say. All the controversies with the European Convention on Human Rights are in relation to its interpretation, and we can discuss that for as long as we want. But I think it's really, really important to have something like the European Convention on Human Rights. And the thought that my government might want to withdraw it from it is deeply, deeply depressing. Of course, justice is being threatened all around the world at all sorts of levels. And it is a time when we, however we define we, have to come solidly behind the subject, worry about what we mean by justice, worry about how one is able to enforce it, what compliance actually means. People only obey the law if they think the law is fair, and if the law isn't fair, then we're all a bit stuck. Within what I had understood to be my brief introductory remarks, I actually wanted to devote some of them to the late, great Professor Sir David Williams. I know he's already been mentioned, and I know that we had a lovely tribute just before tea to Conor Gearty. But let me just give you 2 minutes on David Williams, because he was an extraordinary human being. And I think the human beings are what we're worried about today. His academic legacy is very easy to talk about. First book, Not in the Public Interest, The Problem of Security and Democracy. Passionate about criticizing the expanding laws on official secrecy. In Keeping the Peace, The Police and Public Order, he pointed out so clearly the huge dangers of vague and ambiguous definitions of public order offences and why we had to worry about the use and abuse of discretionary powers, which, even though we all work in very different areas of law, we're all interested in the use and abuse of discretionary powers, and we should focus on that. David Williams had the most fantastic reputation. He had this reputation for integrity and openness, and he carried it out into his personal life. His warmth was very sincere. And as a young academic, I found him extraordinarily welcoming. I faced, as we all do at one point, a moral dilemma in my working life, which was troubling me. And I asked him if I could go and talk to him. I didn't really know him. And he found me all the time in the world to deal with my problem with humanity, humour, all sorts of issues. He was prepared to listen. And that's the value of one of these sorts of discussions, because we can all listen to people who actually come to the world with very different perspectives. And I wanted to mention David as a very great man who knew we were one world and we're not behaving in a way in which one world really ought to behave. The same week that I have the privilege of talking to 95 students of human rights in Tehran, I listened to my government, who wished to stop educational visas for people coming from some of the most vulnerable corners of the world. There won't be many women in Afghanistan who are equipped to apply for PhDs in this country. But I hope that if there are some, we give them massive scholarships and care and attention. and don't say, I'm sorry, you can't come to this country because we can see most Afghans don't go home at the end of their educational visa. There are so many topics that we've got to talk about, and it is easy to despair about the state of the world. And of course, that's what we mustn't do. We've got to, what I decided I would call my version of the David Williams way. My version of the David Williams way is that we have to engage, we have to listen, we have to talk. None of the questions that we're confronting this afternoon are easy, but that's absolutely not a reason not to confront them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Isuru.
Thanks, Tom. In terms of closing remarks, I want to touch upon two themes, and I think we touched upon them already, in terms of enforcement and legitimacy in international law. And I think they are the two key problems we have, and I think they're interrelated. I said earlier that my view is that international law is not under threat. There are breaches of international law, but I'm optimistic about international law as a whole. We've touched upon as a panel some of the problems with the charter system, the permanent five, the veto, violations of Article 2.4 of the UN Charter, the prohibition of use of force. Those things are very real. And they, I think, go to the points of enforcement and legitimacy. The veto, as has been discussed already, stops enforcement. The things we are seeing today and in recent times that violate the territorial integrity of states has been going on for a very long time. The list is very long, sadly. Those things over time have not perhaps been redressed in the manner they should have been because, in part, the Permanent Five and the veto they have had. Some states within the international order have been acting in a way as if international law does not apply to them. And I would suggest that is the device that has enabled them to do so. And Mark Carney has been mentioned many times, and that's one of the points he made. That's a point. The Global South in particular, but international law scholars, heads of state, foreign ministers for the last 70 years have been making all around the world. This system lets you behave like this, but expects me to behave like this. That is a crisis of legitimacy in the system that the Charter has created because of the veto, the Permanent Five, and the consequences that flow. So that is something that needs to be addressed. And there is no easy way to address that. That's enshrined in the Charter. And I don't have an answer to that. But if we don't address the legitimacy problem that creates, I think we keep going. We keep going down this path. How do we stop? How do we change that course that creates a system of international law, the charter system? How do we create it so the 190-odd member states of the UN and others who may become states feel as if they function in a system that is fair to all states, not one that, you know, elevates a certain few and their friends to a level that they can never attain? So that is a big problem, and I think it's a problem of legitimacy in the international order that we have been living in for the last 80 years that needs to be addressed. I don't have an answer to how that becomes, that how you address that, but I think that is one of the key issues in international law at the moment, in terms of enforcement and in terms of legitimacy.
Thank you. And Ambassador Koenigs, if you would take the floor and offer your observations in closing.
Okay.
Before we open.
Thank you. I hope I can share the optimism of the previous speaker regarding international law. I wanted to demonstrate the current threat the threat to international law by a recent case of Greenland. And I hope you
will allow me to elaborate on that. You all know that Greenland has been very high on the international agenda, maybe because of the position of President Trump. He started already 2019 saying that he wanted to buy Greenland, which was then considered as an absurd proposal. But he came back to his proposal in 2025, and he said that the US absolutely wanted to have the US ownership and control of Greenland, that it was an absolute necessity. Now, in the beginning of 2026, of this year, he intensified, President Trump intensified his pressure on Greenland becoming part of the US, and he said it was vital for US security, saying that the island is under threat of Russia and China, and that the US would obtain it in one way or another. And until the meeting in Davos, he even said he refused to rule out the using of military force to acquire Greenland. Now, why does President Trump wants to acquire Greenland? I think because of the strategic location of Greenland for security reasons. Greenland has plays a key role in the Arctic and NATO security framework, but there are US military stations in Greenland itself. Greenland is also of strategic importance because of its very rich resources, very rich earth minerals. And there, the US, EU, and other countries need to have access to these critical minerals in order to increase their independence on the import of critical minerals, for example, where we are dependent mainly of one country, China, for the moment. Now, there are different analyzers saying, well, does President Trump need to have Greenland to reach his objectives? And the answer is clearly no. First of all, access to the rare natural resources. He doesn't need to own Greenland to have access to these resources. He has it already. He does need to own Greenland for security reasons, because the US military already have bases in Greenland, and Denmark is ready to reinforce it. So in practice, President Trump does not have any reasons to acquire Greenland. It's just an expression of the US dominance, power, and control of an immediate neighborhood. And here, his position is a categorical rejection of the rule of international law, a rejection of the principle of self-determination, which is really a common cornerstone of modern international law. And in addition, the use of force to illegally acquire a sovereign territory of a NATO ally would be a serious problem within NATO itself. And if you look at the legal status of Greenland, Greenland is not a sovereign state, nor has independent international legal personality, but it's an autonomous territory of the United Kingdom of Denmark. And that Denmark has the full sovereignty of Greenland is not only recognized under international law, but also the Permanent Court of International Justice in 1933 has confirmed this. So with this autonomous territory, Greenland enjoys the protection of international law. Indeed, Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the UN Charter prohibits, and I said it before, the use of acquisition of territory through force or the threat of force. And you have even a 2009 Act of Greenland of Self-Government, which recognizes the right of self-determination of Greenland. So what Greenland wants and is legally justified to do, Greenland wants on term to become a sovereign state. That's very clear. All political parties agreed on it. They have a strategic document where they say essentially Greenland want to have the way of independence. But the US annexation of Greenland would be absolutely the worst case scenario, because it would mean a complete breakdown of the current international order and of the Western alliance. And why is this? Because a US invasion or annexation of Greenland would be a breach of the prohibition under the use of force under the UN Charter. In the eyes of international law, such an annexation would be void. It would violate the right of the people of Greenland to self-determination. And the victim of the attack, the armed attack, Denmark, would have the right of self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter, whereby each Denmark would have the right to ask other states to assist, and all states would have the right to act. And last but not least, if the United States were to invade Greenland, it would mean the end of NATO, because you have the famous Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, which make it mandatory, it's an obligation for each member to help another member that is attacked. And in this scenario, the strongest country in the alliance would be doing exactly what NATO was created to stop. So all this is just to explain that what is happening, and we don't know if the crisis is yet to an end or not, but in any case, the demonstration of the US is a very clear, a blunt rejection of international law. It's only the primacy of a purely own interest. And here, I think personally that it was thanks to the unity and the firm stand of the European Union, where the European Union explicitly has been said, we remain a firm and unwavering champion of international law and multilateralism. And I think that for the moment balanced a little bit his position. European Union has also said that the territorial integrity and sovereignty are fundamental principles of international law, and this is essential for Europe and the international community as a whole. So this is only a recent example based on Greenland to see how the cracks are in international law. But I think for the moment the crisis has been, maybe he's concentrating now on other areas in the world, but it's just a tendency which is extremely worrying.
Ambassador, thank you very much. Now, we started a little late. Let me ask our organizing team.
Thank you.
When would you want to draw our proceedings to a close so we can have some idea? 5:30. Terrific. Terrific.
I think because Marianne didn't only hear too much about questions. If there are questions directed at her, please let me know, and I'd bring my phone rather than just like